At the Foot of the Cross, a monthly podcast from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome to October's At the Foot of the Cross. As always, when we give you an update from the Secretariat of the Bishops' Conference of England and Wales, there's lots to talk about. I think really, if you're looking at the news headlines, what's been front and centre has been what I might call an unlikely peace. Certainly, we were all praying hard for an end to the war in Gaza, but an end did not look particularly in sight. Now we've had the US President Donald Trump and his deal, his 20-point plan, that has been adopted, at least in as much as we have a phase one of the peace deal. And literally, thanks be to God, we have had hostages released, the hostages that were alive. And sadly, obviously, the bodies of some hostages have been released and they're expecting more. That's not an easy process, I gather. Equally, several thousand Palestinian prisoners, 1,700, 2,000 Palestinian prisoners have also been released as part of this deal. And then, of course, you know, ongoing, we look at the situation in Gaza. There's not much left. There's a heck of a rebuild required. And when I say a rebuild, I think also we're talking about rebuilding people, their hearts and souls. And you know, we have seen that tiny little pocket of Christians, Orthodox Christians, some Baptists, of course, the Catholics at the Church of the Holy Family in Gaza City. And of course, as we often say, you know, everybody, all the Gazans, not just the Christians, it's been incredibly difficult and trying with the food situation, the aid situation, the destruction, bodies under the rubble. Basically, this is a horrendous war for all concerned. So we pray for peace. And I am going to speak to our guest, Abbot Hugh Allen, about his points for prayer, because that's a constituent part of our podcast. Perhaps that will be one of the three. But first of all, Abbot Hugh, I'm going to just simply say hello and how are you?
Hello, James. I'm well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me along to be with you today. It is fantastic to reflect on the events that have unfolded in the Holy Land. It's a remarkable turn of events, you know, none of us expecting it. And I think maybe that's a good thing for us to reflect on sometimes, you know, that our sort of prejudices about people sometimes, that we need to move out of that, which of course is what the Lord's always inviting us to do in the gospel. But, you know, a lot of people aren't particularly fond of Mr. Trump, but I think we need to be grateful for the work that he's done with this and not to be frightened of that. But actually, well, thank goodness, you know, thank goodness that someone was there to do it. And it does show up that we shouldn't allow our prejudices in any way, in any shape or form, stop us from doing what's good. And thanks be to God this has happened, and it's a wonderful moment, but it's also a moment for us to reflect on really trying to reach across barriers wherever they may be, and particularly with our own prejudices with that.
No, you're absolutely right. And of course, you know, I said in the intro that it seemed a bit of an unlikely piece. I didn't see it coming, if I'm totally honest with you.
No, absolutely. Yeah,
but what have you been telling us this whole Jubilee year? We are pilgrims of
hope. Yeah, there you go. You've got to have hope. Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe we've sold that a bit short on this occasion.
Yeah, and and hope is, you know, a great definition of hope is that hope is despair overcome. And you could look at what's been going on and be filled with despair, but hope is despair overcome. And that's why we need to be pilgrims of hope and hold on to that always.
Well, much needs to be done. I think it's important to say this is phase one of a peace deal. There will be hard times ahead to make
sure that ceasefire
holds.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, Israelis, Palestinians, the rest of the world, we all need this to hold. I think it's in the best interests of everybody
definitely,
at this point.
Definitely.
Now, look, we've also had an apostolic exhortation.
Yes, the Holy Father's first one.
The first one, although, might I say, we can see the hands of two popes.
Absolutely. It's the last one of Pope Francis, in a sense, and the first of Pope Leo. Yeah, definitely.
Which we had with Lumen Fidei, didn't we?
Yes, we did before. Yeah. So there's a sort of continuity with that. Yes, it's a similar thing.
And this is, well, amongst other things, it's basically our mission to the poor, the preferential option for the poor that we have, looking at, you know, how we as individuals tie into poverty and what we can do to actually do our just and right mission, literally, to look after the poor.
Yes.
Have you had any encounters in your ministry with those in poverty? And
Well, I mean, in priesthood, you're at the service of everybody, whoever they may be. And a lot of people that we serve, particularly in the parish I live in, you know, I live in South London in the sunny delights of Peckham. And, you know, a lot of the people we look after, you know, they are first generation immigrants coming into this country. A lot of them come with absolutely nothing, you know, so they're having to build up their lives again. And they're always grateful to have a home. And I think that's, you know, one of the things that, you know, Pope Leo talks about that is, you know, in that the church is the home for the poor, you know, and that's a great challenge for all of us to make ourselves welcoming and accept those that come and need to be looked after and taken care of. What I find remarkable as well with that in you know, a parish like Peckham is that, you know, you've got the poor looking after the poor. You know, you've got people who really don't have anything much themselves, but they are giving what they can to help others who perhaps even have less. You know what I mean? So it's a remarkable, I mean, it's a really beautiful thing to see in a sense of those who have nothing giving, you know, what they have to help others. And, you
it's
know,
the widow's mite.
Absolutely. It's wonderful to see. And you know, and doing it in a sense so cheerfully and as well, you know, that it's not done begrudgingly. It's done because they want to live out what the gospel tells them to do. And I think that's as well, you know, the beautiful doctrine from Pope Leo, it's basically what the gospel tells us. You know, he's just explaining more and more what we're commanded to do in the gospels. He does it so beautifully. I really love, you know, Pope Leo's writing with this, particularly when he gets to the saints.
Yeah.
The great quote from John Chrysostom, you know, there's no, you can't recognize Christ at the altar if you don't recognize Christ in the poor man at the door. You know, that's a really big thing. But also going through the history of the church, you know, with the Benedictines and hospitality and then going through with different religious orders and how they've helped the poor.
His very own Augustinian tradition.
Very own Augustinian tradition, bringing that into it. I noticed he didn't mention the Norbertines, but I can write to him and tell him to correct that, you know.
Is that your next letter?
Absolutely. I'll just write to him and say, you know, dear Pope Leo, you know. Well, actually with us, our founder, St. Norbert, but he called the monastery the house of poverty, you know, that the monastery was to be a place where everybody was welcome, particularly the poor, that it was to be a house of poverty. But I loved as well how Pope Leo then went through, you know, saints of the 19th century as well, ones that we may not know about. And of course, you know, incredible figures like Mother Teresa, St. John Paul II, you know, I mean, it was incredible the sort of way he went through the history of the church and how the care of the poor and the service of the poor is at the heart of who we are.
And not just that, of course, we do have the full magisterium of the church. It's
absolutely
very underpinned by
yeah.
scripture.
No,
it's underpinned by the teaching of the pontiffs.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's really, it's incredible. It's really beautiful. And his character comes through in what he's writing. I think it's really wonderful. I think we're truly blessed with him.
Yeah. Now, the other, well, there's many things between sort of mid-October, mid-November, but Nostra Aetate, literally Diamond Jubilee, 60 years old.
Yeah.
And on the 26th of October, although it's not fully a public event at St. Chad's in Birmingham, we're having an event to celebrate that, aren't we?
Yes. It's a really important moment to really come together as people of faith and of goodwill to celebrate our common bond as men and women, you know, created in the image and likeness of God and acknowledging that in each other and being able to, you know, talk. I think it's really important, you know, this is that we should never be frightened of engaging and speaking with each other and, you know, learning from each other, of course, but, you know, not being frightened to share who we are and let that be part of a process as well. So it's a really important moment to celebrate this and to rejoice in this gift. So, yeah, it's something to look forward to.
And sometimes people don't look at translations. I mean, obviously, to make it clear, this is the interreligious dialogue document of the Second Vatican Council.
Yes.
And
yes,
I believe it translates to in our time, is that right?
Yes, that's right, absolutely, at this time. And, you know, we've always got to be aware of that, you know, that we have to be aware of the times we live in. You know, it's one of my favourite St. Augustine quotes, that God has called us to make the times we live in, not the times to make us. And that's something, yeah, we should always be very careful of.
Do you think this is still a relevant document, a foundational document that underpins our dialogue with other religions these days?
Definitely. I mean, that's absolutely. It's, if you like, it's the key for making it work. You know, it's how do we do this together as sharing our common humanity, as sisters and brothers together, that it is a great document for us as a Catholic family in how we talk with others and engage with them. And to do that with always the utmost respect. I mean, that's so important. That's fundamental. You know, it's recognizing, you know, that we are, as I say, made in the image and likeness of God and respecting that in our brothers and sisters too.
And in that event that we'll be holding on the 26th of October, that's a Sunday, It's quite a creative take on it, isn't it? Because we will look at the document. We have Bishop Patrick McKinney, who's obviously our interreligious lead, mm-hmm. Archbishop Bernard Longley, Archbishop of Birmingham, yeah. and very immersed in the interreligious work yeah, in his absolutely. Particular locale.
Yeah.
Cardinal Vincent Nicholls will attend as well. Yeah. And there will be this sort of vespers where those of other religious traditions will offer a small reflection as well. So it's going to be punctuated by those thoughts from those followers of other religions, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's going to be a really good time to come together and be together and just stand together as well, you know, in a time where there is so much division and so much that, you know, we're living in a society and sometimes that seems to be, you know, fracturing in so many ways. Mm. It's our common responsibility to see what we can do to work together. And this is a day to celebrate that.
And then, of course, there's that little section in the middle, which will be to take a sort of contemporaneous look at how people of other faiths work together with one another, with a discussion on other faiths and the end of life, particularly the Birmingham Interreligious Network, I think that is, isn't it?
Yeah, that's really impressive, actually. That's really quite... It's a good thing for us to support each other on because... You know, it's a unifying factor as well.
Yes, it's common ground.
It's common ground on this that we respect the dignity of human life from the moment of creation till the moment we go home to God. You know, that we respect that dignity. And it is a good thing for us to sort of reflect together on what different traditions bring, but that it is a common ground for all of us to share.
Absolutely. Now, Saint John Henry Newman. Oh, you know what I'm going to say, don't
yes.
you?
Yes.
He's going to be declared. Yeah. The 38th Doctor of the Church.
Is it 38th Doctor?
38th.
Right,
second
gosh.
Englishman. 1st of November.
Yep.
So it seems quite appropriate, actually.
Yes, yeah, great Feast of All Saints. John Henry Newman, incredible figure. And I think perhaps the most incredible thing in his life is that courage to follow where his conscience led.
Yeah.
And he could have stayed in a very sort of easy life, very comfortable life in where he was, but he followed, you know, the whisper of God. He followed God speaking to him and calling to him. And that led him, you know, into the Catholic Church and it led to him becoming a priest. I mean, that's incredible. I mean, that really is such a courageous. So a courageous man, a wonderful man, and a great theologian. But also so, I mean, he's an incredible figure around the world. Wherever you go in the world, Newman is loved and admired. I mean, he's a saint for everybody in a sense. You know, you go to America, go to India, go to Spain, go to Italy, and people will talk about Newman, you know. Yeah. I mean, so it's fantastic.
Absolutely. Now, I don't think we're any closer to a date per se. I'm sure there are some people in the know. But we mentioned last month the state visit of the royals, the King and the Queen, the Holy See. That's slated as late October, so I think we should probably stick to that. But nonetheless, that's, you know, quite a few visits. There's been a state visit to Italy that was going to include, but obviously, the visit to the Holy See, but... Pope Francis very sick at that time, so that's completely understandable.
Oh, course,
although we did
yes,
have that
yes.
picture, there was that yes, that
they
moment.
Did, they did meet, yeah, yeah.
But now, obviously, His Majesty the King, Her Majesty the Queen will be meeting Pope Leo.
Oh, it's wonderful. I mean, it's fantastic. And I think it's going to be a great moment of conversation as well that you've got a pontiff, you know, whose first language is English. Mm. And so, you know, the great communication there. Actually, going back to Dilexit, I thought that was an interesting that you could tell, I think, in that document that it was an English speaker, you know, that had written, you know, a large part of it in a sense. Because sometimes in translation, things, nuances can disappear and things, but you could sort of tell with that. So, yes, you know, the King's role as defender of the faith and, you know, in leading the Church of England. So you've got two leaders of two different Christian communities coming together.
That's true.
So it's not just a state, you know, there is a celebration of our dialogue and unity together, you know, so it's an ecumenical moment in a sense, you know.
It does dovetail a bit with Newman, doesn't it?
So yeah, although, it does.
Although
absolutely.
The King may not be around at that exact moment, we know that he's visited Newman's rooms in the Birmingham.
Yeah, he has been to Birmingham. Yeah. There were pictures of that. I saw that. Yeah, wonderful.
So
yeah.
He obviously must have that connection.
Yeah,
and as you say, you know, we've got the two faiths as well, the two Christian confessions, as we would say. But what I thought was really interesting is that the palace does make it very clear that this is also to celebrate the Jubilee. Well, I think
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
It's nice to read that there's acknowledgement of this important event in the life of the church.
So, isn't that wonderful? Yeah. That's great. Oh, no, it's interesting because I've come across that, you know, in lots of the events that we've had for the Jubilee, of how many of our brothers and sisters from other Christian traditions have come together for that as well, that it hasn't just been for the Catholic family, that it's been for others who've wanted to engage and enjoy that and celebrate it. You know, it's been lovely to see that.
So that's another visit that obviously we very much look forward to. It's, would you believe, the centenary, the 100th anniversary of Lancaster Cathedral. Now, I haven't been to Lancaster Cathedral.
Oh, but you're missing out, James.
You
I have been to Lancaster Cathedral. It's a beautiful cathedral. It really is. It's one of those places you go in the door and, you know, it's just breathtaking. I mean, it's a really beautiful building. But added to that, it's not just the beauty that you see, because it is a really beautiful building. It's obviously a building that's prayed in, and you get a sense of that when you go in as well. You know, they keep it open all day, which is fantastic. I mean, sometimes that's not possible in different places, but there it is open and there are always people praying. And so there's a real sense of the beauty of the building, which is stunning, but also that it is a place of prayer and it's the house of God. And you get a real sense of that going there. So it's well worth a visit, James. I recommend you have a day out to Lancaster and go and have a look. It's really nice.
Very well said. Now, I'm going to go on to some sort of slightly more serious matters. Now, this will run for quite a bit longer, I must say, but that's the assisted suicide legislation, bill that has passed through the Commons, sadly. We've been very strong in our opposition to it. Obviously, don't believe it's a dangerous bill as far as we're concerned, certainly when it comes to the dignity of life. Yeah. It's now in the House of Lords. Going to get to that committee stage, so plenty of time it will be in the Lords. It's not a time to despair just because it's passed through the House of Commons. We still maintain our principled opposition to the bill, of course.
Yes.
There are very key concerns. You know, the bill failing to protect healthcare and end-of-life care institutions, hospices, hospitals, care homes. They must be very concerned about being required to facilitate assisted suicide.
Yeah.
So, you know, in its current form, there's that worry. Equally, it doesn't sufficiently protect the right of medical practitioners to opt out of participating in assisted suicide. That's one of our concerns. And then, not to mention, we've talked about coercion before, but it puts the lives of vulnerable patients at risk due to inadequate safeguards around coercion. Mm. So they would just be some of our concerns. We want people to contact a peer, and it doesn't work quite the same as constituencies and, you know, geographical locations as it does with MPs in the House of Commons. But we'd say, please do contact a peer to register your opposition. And we have produced a page on our website to help you do that. It is a bit more old-fashioned. We'd like you to write to a peer, if you would, to say those reasons and others as to why you oppose the bill. Go to our website, CBCEW, Catholic Bishops Conference England Wales, cbcew.org.uk/contact-peers, P-E-E-R-S. So yes, if you feel so minded, we'd be grateful. Please do keep that pressure on. Please let those peers know why you oppose assisted suicide, because we can still make our voices heard. Why don't you give us your points for prayer?
So I would say, I think first and foremost, again, I think I may have said this last month as well, but it's, you know, praying for peace. You know, Pope Leo asked us to say the rosary, pray the rosary each day during October for peace. And I think that's something we should continue to do. Obviously, the fragile peace that's there in, you know, in the Holy Land, but of course, praying for peace throughout the world in so many different places. That's a really important intercessionary prayer for us at the moment. I think second, that is following on from what you just said, I think we need to pray for those in, you know, the House of Lords, in government, in leadership in this country, that their eyes are open to this and that they see what's so wrong in this situation and that they respect the dignity of human life. You know, if I make that, I remember a story, an anthropologist who was once asked, you know, when was the beginning of civilization? And she said, for her, it was when they discovered a bone that was dug up from about 10,000 years ago. And this bone had been healed. So someone had broken their arm and this person had been cared for and healed. And she said this point pointed for her when civilization began, that it was when there was a common humanity where we cared for each other, that we didn't see each other as so much as a burden, that we just wanted to get rid of them, that instead there was care and there was love and there was a concern for someone else. And I think when we pray, that's what we need to pray, that people's eyes are open to that again, that actually, you know, we talk about this as a Christian situation. Actually, not. It's about humanity. It's about who we are as human beings. And it's really that fundamental that we need to pray that, you know, those who are making this legislation and these laws, their eyes are open again to what it means to be a human being, that it's about caring for each other and that no one is ever too much of a burden. So that, particularly praying for that, that people have their eyes open and their hearts open to see why this legislation is so wrong. And then I think it's good, you know, always, I think, praying, you know, for vocations to priesthood, religious life that may not seem a particular priority at the moment, but I think it always is. It should always be for us because, you know, we need women and men, you know, to have the courage to say yes to what God is asking them to do and to, if you like, to be there to support everybody else in living out their Christian life. So I think it's always important that we remember to pray for vocations to religious life and to priesthood. One of my roles as director of mission is I'm also looking after the Office of Vocations. So I'm very aware of that as a job. So those would be my three things to really pray for if we can, to pray for peace, of course, to pray for hearts and eyes to be open to this legislation and how wrong it is, and to pray as well that we have, you know, more brave men and women who will have the courage to say yes to God and to live out their vocation.
Oh, well, fantastic points for prayer. Thank you. Totally agree with you. So still to come on our podcast, we will have that reflection on St. Luke and his gospel, not the Acts. That will be some other time, but we will reflect on St. Luke and his gospel with his feast day on the 18th of October. And I'm not going to give it all away, but we'll hear from two bishops, our Bishop of the Forces, Bishop Paul Mason, and the Ukrainian Eparch, Bishop Kenneth Novikovsky, about an icon that is written. We don't say painted, do we, Abbot Hugh? We say icons that are written.
Yeah, you're meant to say written because it's meant to be the hand of God guiding you when you're doing it, that it is actually meant to be, if you like, a living gospel, I guess, you know, that it's an image of our faith, that it's leading you to the numinous, if you like. It's leading us to something beyond ourselves. So yes, they talk about it as being written.
Yeah, and that's Our Lady of Victory, is a beautiful icon. Mm. And that was actually crafted in Lviv in Western Ukraine at the height of the conflict. And from what I gather, not at all easy to get that out of the country and over into the UK. There was a blessing in the cathedral in Aldershot. Mm-hmm. And that's a wonderful thing. Really, it's for the Catholic Military Association, the patronage mm-hmm. of Our Lady, something to obviously focus their prayers on, our prayers on. Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful little story. So we'll be hearing from two of our bishops telling us why that icon's important and the blessing that happened.
That's fantastic.
In the middle of October.
Oh, that's really good.
But for now, yeah. Abbot Hugh, thank you for your time. I know time is precious and short.
Oh, sometimes. No, when God made time, he made plenty of it. So it's always a joy to be with you, James. So yeah. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. You're a gentleman.
Take care.
Right. Well, it's our biblical apostolate section now on At the Foot of the Cross. And yes, of course, because of that, I'm joined by our biblical apostolate manager, the wonderful Fleur Dorrell. Fleur, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you, James?
I'm very well. Nice to have you in the studio again. Getting
Thank
used
you.
To it?
Just a bit, yeah. Yeah. Dealing with the professionals like yourself, it's yeah, it's good.
Too kind.
It's humbling.
Well, you're a professional too. And I tell you what, I always ask you, what are we tackling? And this month, you've said to us quite rightly, let's look at St. Luke, because obviously we celebrate his feast day on the 18th of October. So should we go sort of right back to the very beginning and start with who Luke was? And you can give us a little bit about his background.
Yes. So our first clue about Luke is when Paul describes him as the beloved physician in his letter to the Colossians. And then since the second century, he's credited with writing both his own gospel and the Acts of the Apostles. Now, most scholars claim that Luke was born at Antioch in Syria and was Greek. But we can't be sure whether he was a Jew or a Gentile, because his writing reflects both those origins and traditions, and the Hellenistic world had a lot of cultural crossovers at that time.
Yeah.
But what we do know is that Luke's gospel is the most literary of them all. And as a Greek, he read widely in the contemporary literature, and he used Greek models of structures, symbols, and images in his writings. Luke is therefore a theologian and a master storyteller. He's an expert in Greek who's adept at combining different traditions and sources to bring the drama alive.
Yeah, absolutely. A very accessible gospel, certainly. And this is interesting, isn't it? Because don't all the gospel writers have a symbol that we quite often see on lecterns, you know, in art, stained glass windows? What's Luke's symbol?
Yes, they do. And this goes back to the 2nd century. The early church father, St. Irenaeus, associated symbols from the books of Ezekiel and Revelation with each of the 4 evangelists. And St. Jerome revived these symbols in the 4th century, where Luke had been depicted as the ox. Now, this might seem rather odd to us today, but the ox actually relates to the sacrifices offered in the Jewish temple, because Luke's gospel begins and ends in the temple. And only in Luke is there a clear link being made between the temple sacrifices and Jesus' own sacrifice on the cross. But also, since the 6th century, Christian tradition has portrayed Luke as an artist, mainly of icons of Our Lady, and he's inspired painters since the Renaissance and St. Francis' crib at Greccio in Italy, influencing many of our familiar Christmas devotions.
Yeah, indeed. Steady on. We'll go back to my secular Franciscanism if you're not careful. That's great, Fleur. So we've got a really decent picture of who Luke is. But now tell us a bit about his gospel.
Well, it's structured in 3 parts. It starts with Jesus' birth and the beginning of his journey from Galilee. He's immersed in the Jewish world of Elizabeth, Simeon and Anna, whose songs and words echo the Psalms and the prophets. Then we have the central journey of Jesus to Jerusalem, revealing God's love and mercy for the poor, the lost and the forsaken. And finally, we have Jesus' arrival in Jerusalem and his return to God, while the emerging church then journeys on from Jerusalem to the ends of the earth in Acts chapter 1. Luke uniquely has Jesus explain everything that's happened to himself to the 2 disciples on the road to Emmaus and in the breaking of bread.
And that's interesting, isn't it? Because letting our listeners into a bit of a secret, off mic, we were talking about those aspects of comedy that can be found in the Bible, and you said that the road to Emmaus was one of those. What did you mean?
Yes, so this is a really good example of comedy in the New Testament. So Jesus is walking along, the 2 disciples don't recognize him, and they come up to him and they're having this chat, and they say to him, because they're surprised, "Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem who doesn't know what's been happening?" So they're saying to Jesus, basically, "Are you the only person who doesn't know what's happened to yourself?" And Jesus replies, "Oh no, do tell me." So then they explain to him, and then he has to correct them and also explain to them why what's happened to him has actually happened. But it's just hilarious the way he goes, "Oh no, do tell me what's been happening to me." I just love that. It's just so funny, and it's brilliant comic typing by Jesus, because he's just so witty at that point, like goading them to explain themselves because they don't actually know it's him. So they're telling the Messiah, "You don't know what you've been up to in the last few days." It's brilliant.
It's quite playful in a way, isn't it?
It is. It's absolutely brilliant.
So instead of an eye roll or a little glance to the camera, if there was such a thing, we get that rather amusing exchange.
Yeah, and then only later do they realise they've said that to the Messiah. It's just brilliant.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's really good. So just to finish this journey story, this motif throughout the gospel allows us to travel alongside Jesus and gradually to grasp the meaning of his role and destiny as the Christ.
Ah, very immersive then. Yeah, very good. So we know that Luke is one of the synoptic gospels, so it can't be that different from Matthew or Mark, or is it? What makes Luke distinctive?
Well, James, quite a lot actually, because there are 6 miracles and 18 parables specific to Luke. And they reflect mental and physical healing. Remember, at the beginning we said he was a physician, so medicine and health are of great interest to him. And only Luke celebrates the depth of divine forgiveness in the story of the prodigal son. And also scandalously, when he forgives a sinful woman who's disrupted a public feast to wash Jesus' feet with her own tears. Then we have hospitality and service as big themes, with Jesus stating, "I am among you as one who serves," in Luke chapter 22. And some of the most famous stories, such as the parable of the Good Samaritan, the widow of Zarephath, Naaman the Syrian, and the one grateful leper, also a Samaritan, all come from Luke's pen. Luke actively promotes Jesus in shared table fellowship with the rich and the poor, the saints and the sinners. And again, it's Luke who has Jesus teach, "Blessed are the poor," and who urges the disciples to share their lives with the outcasts and the destitute. And in Luke's Last Supper, this importantly serves as a transition from the time of Jesus until the time of the church. It becomes a new focus for the disciples, because Jesus' presence at the meal is now linked with their future relationship with him once he's left. So from the Last Supper account to the resurrection story on the road to Emmaus, the risen Christ in his breaking of the bread will become the church's model for how we celebrate Mass today.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting, Fleur. So, look, you've hit your allocated time. I said to you, right, let's keep this nice and sharp. And that's brilliant, actually. So thank you very much. But do you have any final themes to inspire us to read Luke in a bit of a new light now you've said that?
I do, James, because Luke's message is universal. It moves from the poor of God in Judea and Galilee to Jerusalem and Rome and then on to the whole world. Around Jesus, no one is outside the love of God. And while Matthew alludes to the birth of Jesus in one verse only, Luke focuses on the child Jesus entering the everyday world of power, politics and economics, opening up a new way of life, what we call the kingdom of God. Luke portrays Mary as a young woman called to do something extraordinary for God amid her ordinary life. It's Luke who gives us the scriptural basis for our most loved Marian prayer. Hail Mary, full of grace, spoken by the Archangel Gabriel at the Annunciation. And blessed are you and blessed is the fruit of your womb, Jesus, spoken by Mary's cousin, Elizabeth. With Mary and Elizabeth, we see female prophetic companionship. And what I like is the way that Luke depicts them giving themselves up to the mystery of God's call and speaking out of this mystery. When Zechariah the priest is muted, it is these two women's voices which are celebrated. This world is turned right upside down before John the Baptist and Jesus are even born.
Flo, that's wonderful. I have to say, I'm a reader. And, you know, obviously, if you're going to do it properly, you should read first. You should understand what you're reading, put it into the correct context. And that, I have to say, I mean, I'm sure this will be very beneficial for all our listeners, but it's certainly been beneficial for me. Now, I guess what we really should point out is that we've talked a lot about Luke's gospel here, naturally. But we should, in the future, to challenge you yet further, look at how Luke tackles the Acts of the Apostles. Are you up for doing that?
Yes, definitely. I think it's very important to see both those texts by the same author. Yeah,
yeah, perfect.
I'd love to do that.
Excellent. But I know you have plans for November. They do say the month to remember, don't they, when they're playing with words a bit. Should we give a little bit away or should we keep that up our sleeve?
No, I think we can hint. I think it'd be good to look at death and dying in scripture and how the concepts of both develop in the Bible. And I think there are some interesting things for people to think about and reflect on during that cold, dark month.
Indeed. Well, you'll warm us up with your wonderful scriptural reflections, Fleur. So thanks ever so much. And I'll really look forward to talking to you next month.
And thank you, James. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, you're too kind. Thanks, Fleur. Okay, so we're finishing our podcast today with a story of prayerful light in the darkness. Now, sadly, the horrors of the war in Ukraine are still manifest, even as the conflict has drifted in and out of the headlines. But on the 7th of October, the focus was very much on the victory of peace over war, as two of our Catholic bishops took part in the blessing of an extraordinary icon, a Ukrainian icon, that was written in the western Ukrainian city of Lviv at the height of the conflict by artist Oksana Zuravska. The icon of Our Lady of Victories was made with help from the charity Aid to the Church in Need, and it was painted over a course of more than a year, actually, depicting the Blessed Virgin Mary with the child Jesus. It was commissioned by the Catholic Military Association here in the UK and was supported financially by the Katinians, an organisation of Catholic laymen, if you haven't come across them before. The blessing that took place on the Feast of Our Lady of Victories at St Michael and St George's Catholic Cathedral in Aldershot was led by Bishop Kenneth Novikovsky, Eparch or Bishop of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Eparchy of the Holy Family of London, and of course Bishop Paul Mason, the Catholic Bishop of the Forces, who's based at the cathedral. Bishop Novikovsky reflects on the day.
It was an honour to be invited by the Catholic Military Association, Aid to the Church in Need, and the Continuance to participate in the blessing of the icon of Our Lady of Victories with His Excellency Bishop Paul Mason. This beautiful icon was written by a young Ukrainian iconographer from Lviv, Ukraine, and specially brought to Great Britain to be placed in the Cathedral of St. Michael and St. George at Aldershot for veneration and Marian prayer devotions. Our Lady of Victories heralds the victory over death and captivity by evil that her Son's death and resurrection has won for His sisters and brothers. We place those who are defending the United Kingdom, Ukraine, and indeed Europe during this time of war under the protection of the Holy Mother of God as patroness of victory.
Speaking after the blessing, Bishop Paul Mason offered his thoughts outside the cathedral.
My name is Paul Mason. I'm the Catholic Bishop of the Armed Forces. And we've just had a service to bless an icon which the Catholic Military Association had commissioned. And the idea of the icon is to give a sense of a patronage of the Blessed Virgin Mary for the organisation, and to have her as a focus of their devotion. And we've had this made in Ukraine, and so it's been a joint effort with the people in Ukraine, who have actually done the artwork and written the icon for us. And the CMA see this as a focus for their prayer, for their efforts, and to show that what they do is very much focused on their faith, with the Blessed Virgin Mary there to support them through their prayer. The icon is going to be fundamentally, it will be based here at the cathedral, but like many such icons, we'll be taking it to different places so that people can have the opportunity to see it and to venerate it. So, for example, if I were visiting somewhere, a barracks, a ship, or an airbase, it provides an opportunity for Catholics who serve there, who may not be able to get to the cathedral, to be able to come and to venerate the icon at a mass locally, wherever I may be celebrating it.
Oh, well, good to hear from two of our bishops there, the Catholic Bishop of the Forces, Bishop Paul Mason, and the Ukrainian Catholic Eparch of the Holy Family of London, and that's Bishop Kenneth Novikovsky, about that wonderful icon that was written in Lviv in Western Ukraine and brought over to the UK. Our Lady of Victory is beautiful and well worth praying for Our Lady's patronage there. Listen, thank you very much for joining us on this At the Foot of the Cross. Our bishops meet in plenary in November next month, so that's something for us to talk about and look back on. But for now, thank you for your time. Thank you very much for listening. Do remember, if you feel so motivated, and I really hope you do, it would be very useful for you to register your opposition to the assisted suicide legislation, that bill that is currently in the House of Lords. Please do contact a peer and let them know those reasons why we don't believe this to be a safe bill. www.cbcew.org.uk/contact-peers, and that will give you all the information, and of course you can craft that in any way you desire. So thanks for listening, have a good month, and we'll be back with you very soon indeed.